on May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans. That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Hello, Brett here. Before we get to today's show, got a quick favor to ask of you. If you've been enjoying the Art of Manliness podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps us out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you so much. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member if you think we'd get something out of it. Word of mouth is the primary way the Art of Manliness grows and spreads. So please share. Text a friend, send an email, do whatever, however you communicate. Tell them to check out a particular episode if you think they'd get something out of it. Thank you for continued support. And now on to the show. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. When it comes to fitness and nutrition, the nutrition part can cause a lot of confusion. There's so much information out there about which is the best diet to follow, and often that advice is contradictory. My guest today is here to clear up some of that confusion. His name is Robert Santana. He's a registered dietitian, a PhD candidate in nutrition and exercise science, a starting strength coach, and the nutrition coach at Starting Strength Online Coaching. Today on the show, we discuss all things diet and nutrition. We begin with a big picture overview of the three main macronutrients our body uses to function and the science of their effect on the body. Robert walks us through how our body partition nutrients as we consume them and explains exactly how we get fat and how we store body fat. In the process, Robert debunks a lot of popular ideas people have about nutrition these days, like eating carbs makes you fat and eating fat is an easy way to lose body fat. In fact, he argues if you're trying to gain muscle mass and wanting to lose some body fat in the process, you might need to be eating more carbs than you are now. He then walks us through the science of fat loss and gives practical examples of what a diet needs to look like if you want to lose weight while also maintaining muscle. We also talk about how to gain weight that's more muscle than fat, and we end our conversation discussing my experience in cutting weight, what I eat from day to day, and why trying to get six-pack abs isn't necessarily a healthy goal. A lot of information here. Check out our show notes at aom.is/Santana, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. And Robert joins me now via clearcast.io. Robert Santana, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you are a starting strength coach, but you're also a registered dietitian, and you're also my personal nutrition coach. And we'll talk, maybe we can talk about some of the stuff you've been doing with me. But before we get into that, let's talk about your background. Obviously a barbell coach, nutrition. I'm curious, what came first? Was it the barbell training or the diet part, or did they both kind of start at the same time?
I'd have to say probably the lifting, because that dates back to when I was a kid. Diet stuff came later, but I tended to grasp the diet stuff a little bit easier. I think it took me longer to really get a handle on the training.
And then now, I mean, you've continued, besides being a registered dietitian, you've continued your education. You're getting your PhD, correct, in nutrition science?
That is correct. The degree is actually kind of interesting. It's interdisciplinary, so it's in exercise and nutritional sciences. So I've been spending time in both areas. I've taken some nutrition classes. I've taken some exercise classes. I've helped with nutrition study. I'm currently running an exercise study. So I got my head in all of it right now.
Is there something you've been focusing on in particular?
My dissertation project is focusing on the effects of weightlifting essentially on arterial stiffness. So basically how lifting affects your arteries, for the layman's version of that.
Okay. Well, let's get into like nutrition. Because I think, in my experience, I think this is the same for a lot of people. I mean, you said nutrition came easy to you, but I think for a lot of people, nutrition is the hardest or most confusing part of of health, because there's so much information out there and it's constantly changing, right? We'll talk about this. Like, you know, one time it's like, hey, carbs are great. You got a carbo load. And like, no, no, no. Carbs are evil. You need to do paleo or Atkins or something. It's all always changing. Let's talk big picture first, and then we'll let that guide the rest of the discussion. When it comes to nutrition and performance, you're primarily focusing on, you know, the big macronutrients, which is protein, carbs, and fat. Let's walk through what does each one of these macronutrients do for us physiologically and in terms of performance?
Sure, of course. So protein is the one most lifters are familiar with. And that's because you think about protein, you think about muscle. So muscles are comprised of proteins. But when you're trying to build muscle, you have to break them down so that they can build up larger. And the way that happens is you start adding more muscle proteins. And that's going to require additional protein than somebody who's basically sedentary. So when you want to think of protein, you want to think of recovery. You want to think of basically building body protein. So to take that a step further is we're not just talking about muscle. We're talking about hair, skin, nails. All that is driven by your protein intake. So you'll find with like elderly individuals, for instance, if they're not eating enough protein, they tend to, their skin gets brittle, their hair gets brittle. They also get weaker for reasons that most of my clientele would understand. And simply by giving them more protein, you'll tend to see that their hair will grow a little bit fuller, their nails will grow a little bit thicker, their skin will improve, etc. So proteins build things. That's how you want to think of protein. When it comes to carbs, that's your energy source. And this is where things get kind of funny with the information. Typically, we store about a good chunk of carbs as stored glucose. So you want to think of when you eat carbs, are going to store some of that in your muscles and in your liver, and that's called glycogen. Glycogen is your stored form of glucose. Now, to take that a step further, all carbs get converted into glucose. That's what they do. They get converted into glucose, and then a lot of that gets stored. So the average person who's 70 kilograms is going to have about 425 grams of glucose is stored as muscle glycogen. About roughly 75 grams is stored as liver glycogen. So that's pretty much the fate of carbs in terms of energy storage. Now, also, you got to put that in the context of activity, right? So carbs have a linear relationship with the intensity of an activity. So the more intense an activity is, basically the harder you're moving, the harder you're pushing, the faster you're running, the heavier you're lifting to a certain extent. And I'll go back to that. You're going to be using more carbs. So if you're going for a light jog, it's probably an even mix. And then as that pace gets faster and faster, you're going to rely more on carbohydrates. So you want to think, the harder the activity is that you're doing, the more carbohydrates you're typically going to need. In a lifting context, you have your three energy systems. You know, you have your ATP, phosphocreatine, and that's basically the system that's responsible for fast, rapid, explosive activity. So maybe your first rep on a set of five, you're primarily using ATP and phosphocreatine. And then if you know you're doing a set of 8, 10, 12, you know, you're going to start tapping into that muscle glycogen. And then once you start getting over 20 reps or you start doing aerobic exercise, now you're in oxidative metabolism. So you're going to be using a good mix of fat and carbs. But at least in the beginning, it starts with ATP phosphocreatine, then transitions over into glucose in the form of glycogen. You need carbohydrates essentially to perform in any sport. It's not just lifting. If you're a runner, you're going to need carbohydrates. If you're a cyclist, you're going to need them. If you're a weightlifter, if you're a football player, and it's because the activity is more intense than resting. Now, that doesn't mean that when you're resting, you're burning 100% fat, and I'll go to fat next. But basically, when you're resting and you're on a mixed diet, you're going to get an even mix of both. You're going to be burning fat and carbs. In general, as activity becomes more intense, you rely more on carbs. That leaves me with fat. So what is fat used for? Well, it's used for a lot of things. So we have these things in our bodies called membranes. And those membranes are found in all of our cells. And the integrity of those membranes rely on fat. Fat forms a lot of those membranes. Number two, we have certain vitamins that require fat for absorption. So you have your vitamin A, your vitamin D, your vitamin E, and your vitamin K. Those are your fat-soluble vitamins. You have to consume fat in order to absorb those. So that's number two. And then number three, this is fat's primary storage. And, you know, the most popular among most people is you store it as energy. Fat's your energy depot. It's the most easily converted into stored body fat, which is basically stored triglyceride, if you want to use a scientific term. Some of your audience probably knows what that means. Some don't. But basically, fat stores as fat. primarily, and then it's also used for other physiological processes.
Okay, so that's a good like sort of overarching view of like what these macronutrients do. So let's get into the details of this. Let's talk about carbs, right? So you said that we use carbs to do intense exercise, high intensity running, weightlifting, etc. Let's say like when you consume carbs, like how does our body figure out like when to partition carbs to stored glycogen or when to use those carbs you consumed immediately for energy use? Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. Good question. You're typically not like if let's say you're eating and you're working out, you're probably not going to use what you're eating. You're probably going to tap into your stored glycogen first because it's easier to get to. You know, you have to, when you eat carbs, you have to digest them, absorb them, etc. So typically when you start exercising, you're going to start tapping into muscle glycogen first.
But how soon do carbs that we consume become accessible? Do we know that even? Because you hear all this thing about carb timing. Well, I'm going to eat a fast digesting carb, you know, an hour before working out. Is there anything to that or not?
Oh, I see where you're going with that. Yeah. So there's this thing called the glycemic index. And it basically is a classification system for how your body responds to carbs in terms of changing blood glucose levels, whether, you know, going up. When you eat carbs, your blood sugar goes up. And depending on where those carbs are coming from, that's going to influence that response. And then what they've done is I don't know how many decades ago, they basically studied the effects of different foods on blood glucose levels and came up with these values for the glycemic index. Now, the limitation of the glycemic index is that we're rarely just eating carbs. I mean, I guess it depends on the person. You know, some people might eat a whole bag of Skittles, but assuming that, you know, you're eating a mixed meal, that glycemic index kind of goes out the window, because if that meal has things like protein, fat, or fiber, that's going to affect your blood glucose response, which leads me to your question about, okay, do you want a fast-acting carb or slow-acting carb? Yeah, sure. So if you eat something like Skittles, that would be considered a fast-acting carb because that's basically, you know, sucrose, which is table sugar, and that's half glucose, half fructose, and fructose being fruit sugar. And you're typically going to absorb that fast. Maltodextrins also absorb pretty rapidly. And then pure glucose, if you get like something like a dextrose supplement, that's going to be pretty much, there's no conversion it has to go through. It just goes straight to glucose. It's already glucose, so you can use that right away. But typically, the best time to take those in is either after a workout, during a workout, if it's a very long workout, and not necessarily because it's going to like, you know, dramatically increase your performance, but you don't want to bottom out your blood sugars either. And that also depends on how you ate throughout the rest of the day. So these guys sitting in the gym chewing on fruit snacks, that may not be necessary depending on what the situation is. But the idea there is that, you know, if you need carbs rapidly for something like, okay, I just had an intense bout of exercise, I broke down a bunch of muscle glycogen, I need to replenish that right away, or I went for a 5-hour run, you know, because I'm training for a marathon. Yeah, you want to take in something like a dextrose supplement or maybe a Gatorade, which has various fast-acting carbs in them, to basically replenish that muscle glycogen. Or if you're on a diet, for instance, you know, you're operating probably on partially or fully, depending on what your diet is, depleted glycogen stores. So you're going to need glucose during your workout because you're basically running on empty anyways. And you also don't want to have your blood sugar drop because that's going to kill your energy for that reason.
All right. So bottom line is, for the most part, when you exercise, the carbs you're using are the carbs that have been stored as glycogen in your muscles. For the most part.
Typically, yeah. Typically, yes.
Oh, well, let's talk about fat. It's because you've probably seen this as a dietitian in the past. Man, it's been going on for 20 years. First, there's the Atkins diet and saying carbs are bad. They make you fat. Eat more fat and you'll lose weight or lose body fat. Then it turned into the paleo diet, which pretty much said the same thing. And now we're seeing a new version, the carnivore diet, where people just eat meat and that's it. And so it's high protein, high fat. I mean, is there any truth to this idea that the more dietary fat you eat, that you'll burn, your body will become better at burning fat, so you'll burn stored body fat more efficiently?
The short version of that answer is yes and no, and I'll explain why. So yes, you become more efficient at burning fat. Now, why that happens, I'll explain it. So each macronutrient oxidizes or burns differently than the other macronutrients. So you have fat, carbohydrate, protein, alcohol's technically a macro, depending on who you ask, but typically fat is easily converted to fat. It doesn't have to go through any alternate pathways to become stored body fat. Now, when you start overfeeding these macronutrients, your body responds to that in different ways. So they've done studies on individuals that are following a mixed diet, you know, so carb, fat, protein's pretty even, nothing's extremely high or extremely low, you know, just a mixed diet. And they've basically overfed them carbs and overfed them fat and looked at the responses. The classic study I like to cite is Tracy Horton's study. I believe it was, I want to say it was done in the 90s, maybe early 2000s. I don't have the exact date, but they basically found that when you overfeed carbs to somebody on a mixed diet, they tend to burn more carbs. They see an increase in carbohydrate oxidation, which means you're burning more carbs because you're eating more carbs. So to put that simply, the more carbs you eat, the more carbs you burn. They stimulate their own oxidation. Just simply eating more of them makes you burn more of them. But then something else happens. As you eat more carbs, you start burning less fat because you have to burn off those carbs. So what they also looked at was the proportion of those calories is stored as fat. So basically what happens is all the fat that you're eating gets stored as fat because you're burning off the carbs. So, you know, we'll go back to that later in terms of, you know, practical considerations there. But when you look at what happens when you overfeed fat to somebody on a mixed diet, it's a very different response. Absolutely nothing happens. And why does absolutely nothing happen? Well, because you start storing that fat. See what I mean? Fat does not stimulate its own oxidation. It just gets stored because that's the preferential fate of dietary fat. So now your questions in regards to, well, you become a better fat burner if you're on a low fat diet or a low carb diet. So just think about what we just talked about. If you eat more carbs, you burn more carbs. So what if you restrict carbs down close to zero? You know, nobody's going to actually eat zero, but let's say you're eating 20 carbs a day. The opposite happens. You become less efficient at burning carbs because you're not eating them, right? And carbs stimulate their own oxidation. So your ability to burn carbs decreases. What ends up happening is you become a better fat burner. Your fat oxidation goes up, and now you're eating a bunch of fat to, you know, compensate the calories you need. What happens there is you become more efficient at burning dietary fat. So this is what people forget. Physical activity and exercise and even lifting, you know, the way we lift for a couple hours a day, you know, a few times a week, you know, assuming that you're not a professional athlete who's, you know, putting in an 8-hour day of physical activity and you're just, you know, you're a recreational person that lifts 1 to 3 hours a day, depending on how into the activity they are, you're typically not really burning that many calories performing physical activity, you know. So like these people that are on the treadmills, you know, trying to sweat and run for an hour at, like, you know, get their heart rate racing. I mean, you're talking about what, 400 calories extra a day? You know, I mean, that's another, you know, meal depending on the person and what they like to eat. But we're not talking about, hey, we're doubling your caloric expenditure by running for an hour, or, you know, we're just roasting away fat by doing the linear progression. You know, that's not what's happening. You know, physical activity probably accounts for, or exercise, I should say, accounts for, you know, roughly 15% of what you expend as energy. So that means you have another 85% there that goes to basically you just being alive, you know? So I said, what, about 15% for exercise, maybe 20 if you're, you know, an enthusiast and really going at it. And then about 10 to 15% goes to digesting and absorbing food. So just eating burns calories. It's called diet-induced thermogenesis. So as you eat food, you end up burning calories in the digestion and absorption of those nutrients. So right there, you're about 30 to 35%. So that means about 65% of your energy expenditure is just you being there, being alive, breathing, living.
Well, so, okay, there's a lot to unpack there. So I want to point out there, what you just said there is if you eat lower carb, you become less efficient at oxidizing carbs. And if you eat higher fat and you're to make up those calories you're not consuming from carbs, you become more efficient at burning dietary fat. So you don't become more efficient at stored fat. So the fat that's around, like that causes love handles and everyone's trying to get rid of, right? That doesn't become more efficient.
No, that is determined primarily by your resting metabolic rate.
So, but I mean, you see like these amazing, like before and after pictures of people like, oh, this is me before paleo and before I was eating carbs. Here's me after I went to a low carb, high fat diet and I lost a lot of body fat. So like what's going on there? If it's not that they became more efficient at burning stored fat, why did they lose the body fat?
So the last thing I said was it depends on your resting metabolic rate. What I mean by that is you need to expend a certain number of calories over what you're burning, right? So the classic rule is 3,500 calories. You subtract 500 calories a day for 7 days. So that's, you know, 3,500 calories. It's 1 pound of fat. You lose a pound of fat a week. Actually, that's not 100% accurate because there's variability there in terms of how much of a calorie restriction is necessary to lose a pound of fat. That varies between individuals. But let's just go with that rule for the sake of explaining this. So if you're resting metabolic, let's say you burn 1,500 calories a day. Let's not even talk about resting. Let's talk about everything you do, exercise, living, eating, etc. You're burning 1,500 calories a day. And let's say you need to subtract 500 to lose a pound. You need to subtract 1,000 to lose 2 pounds. You need to subtract. So basically, you're eating zero calories to lose 3 pounds a week. Nobody's going to do that. So there's a math problem there if you think about it, right? You have to subtract a certain number of calories. And unless you're burning 6,000 calories at rest, most humans aren't going to lose more than a pound or two a week just because of the math there. So let's tie it back to your question about what's going on here, where they're eating keto or they're doing low carb and they're losing fat. Well, that's because fat loss, the loss of stored body fat is driven by being in a negative energy balance. That means the calories you take in are less than the calories you put out. And that doesn't matter if it's low carb or low fat or low protein or high protein. If you're expending X amount of calories and you're eating less than that, you're going to lose body fat regardless of how you break down those nutrients. Now, there's one caveat there. If you're trying to skew your weight loss towards body fat and away from muscle mass, that's where you have to keep the protein high.
Gotcha.
And lift, obviously.
Right, right. So what you're saying there is that your body only dips into those fat stores, right? And we're talking like love handles, the thing that makes you doughy, only when there's a caloric deficit. That's at that point when it will start burning that, right? And you start losing body fat.
That's 100% correct.
Okay. And so, I mean, I guess that's why the paleo diet works. It's not that, you know, there's something magical about fat, eating fat. It's just that when you eat paleo, you probably tend to consume less calories because, you know, you're eating a lot of protein and fat, which are filling. And so you're not hungry all the time. And so you just eat fewer calories.
Pretty much, yeah. When you're on a high protein, high fat diet, you tend to those two macronutrients are more satiating than carbs. So if you eat a lot of fat, a lot of protein, you tend to be fuller. It's hard to overeat calories for a lot of people. Now, there's some people with very slow metabolic rates that don't lose on those diets either. Nobody ever talks about them.
Right. Yeah. What causes that slow metabolic rate? Is it genetic or is it environmental? Do we know?
For the most part, it's genetic, but also if you've, and this doesn't apply to everyone, because everything is genetic to some extent, to a large extent, actually, you know. And if you gain and lose weight a bunch of times, your metabolic rate tends to adapt to that by lowering. So if you are an obese person and you just starve yourself and lose 50 pounds and regain the 50 pounds, your metabolic rate may be slower than it was before you initially lost the 50 pounds, even though you weigh the same. Weight cycling plays into it, but primarily, let's assume that that's not a factor. It's driven by genetics. Some people are going to burn 5,000 calories at rest. Some people are going to burn 1,200 calories at rest. And that's just the name of the game. Pick better parents.
Right, right. Well, what happens when we actually, let's talk about that. What happens when you burn fat? Because as you said, I think a lot of people, they get on the treadmill and they think I'm sweating out the fat or I'm breathing. Like, what happens to the fat cell that make, do they disappear? Do they shrink? What happens there?
Well, that's a good question. So the fat cell is 87% triglyceride, and that's what you're using as energy. So 87% of that fat cell is triglyceride. The other 13% is your cellular machinery, and you can't burn that off. That's part of your body, you know, that gets, you know, dies and gets replaced. So, you know, there's been confusion about that on the starting strength boards. You know, these guys are citing studies and not really interpreting the data correctly, but every cell in your body turns over. That means it dies and gets replaced with a new one. But fat cells they're not an exception to that rule. You're turning them over, but you're not going to lose more fat cells than you're replacing. It's typically a 1-to-1 ratio. So when you're losing body fat, those fat cells are getting emptied essentially, but they're not actually losing the fat cells.
The strength con, you mentioned this, kind of talk about this interesting study. I think you actually talked about this at Starting Strength Coach Association meeting about body fat and how, like, generally, so there's a 1-to-1 ratio, right? So a fat cell turns over, you know, it dies or whatever, and then it's replaced by a new fat cell. You started to say that some people actually create more fat cells than they need, or that And that, you know, so even if they like make those fat cells shrink, right, by tapping into those stored fat storages, like they're not going to get much skinnier because they've got more fat cells than they had when they were, you know, born or when they were a kid.
The total number of fat cells a human has is determined primarily by genetics. And then, you know, there's data suggesting that, you know, environmental stuff can influence that as well. So typically when you're born, you're probably adding most of your fat cells in that first year of life. You're proliferating them at a very rapid rate. And that continues all the way to about 20 years of age. You're adding new fat cells and they're expanding to some extent. After about age 20, early adulthood, it's believed that that stopped happening. And any increase in fat mass is due to an increase in fat cell size, not fat cell number. There's some data out there suggesting that some people might be able to add more fat cells and expand them at the same time. So this is probably like your 600-pound person. You know, how does that happen? So there might be some genetic things going on there that may be causing that person to add fat cells as an adult. But we don't know that for sure. Generally, for most people that are not your 600-pound person, you're typically getting an increase in fat cell size. So to put that into context, when you're trying to lose weight, they did a this was a hot topic in the late 60s, early to mid 70s. They did a lot of studies on fat cells, and they were doing adipose tissue biopsies where they, you know, took a piece of fat out of the person and, you know, determined their fat cell size, fat cell number, and saw how they responded to different things, primarily diet. So they were, there was one in particular that comes to mind where they got a group of women. And I mean, this wasn't the best research design. So I'm not saying that, you know, oh, this is fact, but they had a group of women back in the 70s. They told them, all right, lose as much weight as you can on any diet you want, and then come back to us when you can't lose anymore. So they basically had everybody diet to a plateau. And then they took a sample of their fat cell before and after. And what they found was that there was a trend towards a measure of about 0.1 micrograms in weight, and nobody got below that. So there's, you know, the theory is that there's a certain size at which the fat cell cannot get any smaller, that when it empties out, it's roughly about 0.4 micrograms. Now, again, you know, this is not a fact based on this study, but, you know, it gives us some idea of what tends to happen for at least, you know, a group of people. So maybe some person might be able to get lower than that. Well, so what? The point is that there was no indication that fat cell number decreased in these individuals.
Okay. So I guess the big takeaway from this then is when you're exercising, you're not burning fat, probably. You have to be in a caloric deficit to lose body fat. And there might be a certain point, like there's a fat cell can only shrink so small, and that's about as low as it gets. And then some people, like the 600-pound person, they're actually, they've probably had an increase in number of fat cells and an increase in the size of those fat cells. And it's probably going to be really hard for them to lose body fat.
Most likely, yes.
Okay. Well, let's talk about, I mean, the other thing, we've had people on the podcast discussing, you know, endurance athletes particularly, talking about the wonders of, you know, low carb, high fat diets. And they talk about ketones and like how they're like this like clean source of energy that, you know, allows you to run forever and, you know, you think clearer or whatever. So like, for those who aren't familiar, what are ketones and how does that power the body in just day-to-day living or even, say, strenuous exercise?
Well, sure. So ketones. So when you're on a mixed diet, you're primarily operating on carbs. The brain's preferred fuel are carbs because fat's a big, large molecule. It can't get up there. Your brain can't effectively use it. When you restrict carbohydrates and now you're relying on fat as an energy source, because you can't use fat, your body starts releasing these substances called ketones. And that's what you start using for energies. And basically, it's the best way to explain these is ketones are a collection of fuels that your liver uses, and your liver manufactures it. So your liver makes these ketone bodies, and your brain is able to use that for energy when you're deprived of glucose. So let's say you're on a low-carb diet, and you're at like 20 grams a day. Your brain's like, hey, I need more glucose. And, you know, by the way, your brain typically needs around 130 grams of carbohydrates a day to function effectively. So when you're on a low carb diet, your liver basically starts making these ketones from stored fatty acids. It's like an emergency backup fuel to keep your brain functioning well. That's what happens. You're eating all these fats and then you're not getting carbs to your brain to function. So then your liver's like, hey, let's take some of these fatty acids and make these little things called ketones so that our brain can continue to work.
Yeah, that makes sense. So it's basically there for brain function. It doesn't do anything for aerobic function. Like I've heard that like ketones are great for aerobic activities. Is that, I guess that's not the case.
No. So, you know, there's an old paper on keto adaptation and endurance exercise performance, and everybody loves to cite it. And what they found was that, you know, some of these cyclists or runners, I can't remember offhand, it's been a while since I read the paper, but they were looking at endurance athletes that were on ketogenic diets, and they were making this case that, hey, maybe they just need to be in ketosis longer so they can keto adapt. And once they're keto adapted, you know, then they can operate on a low carb diet and use fat as an energy source, and it should be fine. But when you look closely at the data, what they typically don't say is that, hey, the guys who were the most keto adapted also had the poorest performance. So no, you typically can't use that for immediate energy.
So we talked about fat. Let's talk about carbs. So, you know, carbs have been getting a bad rap. They're evil. They make you fat. They cause inflammation, et cetera, et cetera. Are carbs that evil? Do they deserve the bad rap they've gotten?
No. In short, no. First of all, what foods are high in carbs? You know, your grains are high in carbs. Typically keto people eat vegetables, so I'm not going to include that in the list, but vegetables are very nutrient dense. They have a lot of micronutrients in there. Your fruits have a lot of good micronutrients, and also high in fiber. So are the whole grains. So are things like beans, right? And fiber is good for lowering cholesterol levels. There's a lot of benefit to fiber. It increases gastric motility. So it's good for your intestinal health, improves your good gut bacteria. So you get all that from carbs. You don't get that from eating meat and, you know, protein primarily. So you get a lot of that from carbs. And depending on your carb sources, some of them enhance absorption of certain nutrients better than others, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. All right. So yeah, carbs help with just like fat. Fat helps with vitamin absorption. We need that for vitamin D, vitamin A. Carbs can help with vitamin absorption for these other vitamins.
Yep.
Do carbs cause inflammation? Because that's the one thing people say. I as soon as I eliminated carbs, like my skin cleared up, I've gotten rid of, you know, whatever digestive issues I've had. What's going on there when people say that? Or is there anything to that?
I think we really got to think about what type of carbs are these people talking about? What is an average American who's on a quote unquote high carb diet or a poor diet eat, right? Let's give some examples. Donuts, hamburgers, French fries, fast food, right? I feel like a lot of people have this one-dimensional view that, oh, I just cut the carbs out and I feel better. But hold on a second. Let's look at these foods I just listed. French fries are carb, right? But they're also fat because they're deep fried. Potato chips, you know, I think people would classify that as a carb, but those are also high in fat. Donuts, you know, you think about how sweet they are because of the sugar. Well, donuts are high in fat too. They're deep fried. So they're usually cutting out both carbs and saturated and trans fat from their diet is what's happening. And they're eating overall fewer calories. So I don't know, you know, this is one of the problems with nutrition research is I don't know exactly what people are eating. Nobody does. You know, a lot of our science is based off what people say they eat. And I was recently at a conference, I think it was a little over a year ago. And this biostatistician gave a presentation on this. And he was talking about how we've been following data for the last 30 years on what people say they eat and making recommendations off of it. And, you know, he finished off his talk by saying, this is an example of when something is not better than nothing. And until we have a better way of measuring it, we probably shouldn't even report on this. So his name was David Allison, by the way, great researcher. It was great because it put it into context, right? So you're saying all these things that people say, but are they really eating bananas and oranges and apples and whole grains and beans all day? Probably not, right?
Right. So, okay, we talk about, so carbs, they're not evil. We need them for performance. Like, but what happens to an individual who's doing strength training or even endurance training and they go low carb? How will that affect performance?
Well, here's what happens. Let's say you're an endurance athlete and you're what's called in steady state exercise for most of your activity until the very end when you have to do an all-out sprint. You're a marathon runner. So your workouts are going to be several hours long, depending on where you're at in your training. And you might do this every day. Well, the thing people fail to realize is when you're in steady state exercise, you're not burning 100% of your calories from fat. Steady state is not laying down on a couch. You know, you're running at a decent pace that you can sustain for, you know, several hours. And you're burning both fat and carbohydrates. And if you keep doing that long enough, eventually you deplete your glycogen stores and you can't effectively run. Your blood glucose levels drop, your energy levels drop. And if you're actually racing, you're not going to do very well at the last leg of the race when you need to sprint.
And for weightlifters, I guess you get weak, basically.
That's the end result, but it's kind of a similar concept. So lifting's a little bit tricky. So what you want to think about is none of these energy systems are 100% working by themselves at any point in time. All three of them are working together. So just to review back to earlier, you have your ATP phosphocreatine for explosive activities. Then you go into what's called glycolysis, where you're using primarily glucose. And then you go into oxidative metabolism, where you're using a little more fat. But at no point are you just using one. They're all always operating, just depending on what your activity is. You might use one more than the other. So in the weight room, for instance, let's say you're doing a set of five, right? Let's say you're doing five sets of five to put this into better context. So you have to unrack the bar, you got to walk out, you do your first rep, second rep gets slower, third rep gets slower. By the time it's all said and done, it might take 10 to 15 seconds, maybe 20, depending on how heavy it was. So by the end of it, you start tapping into glycolysis, and now you're breaking down muscle glycogen in that single set of five. And then you're going to follow it up in a few minutes, right? So you still have to replenish ATP phosphocreatine so you can use that again in the next set. And if you're not resting long enough, you're not going to be able to do that, which is why it's going to be harder. And by the end of it, you've done 25 reps with this at this high intensity. The sets tend to take longer and longer. So you, instead of continuously breaking down glycogen like you would in like an endurance activity, it's more incremental because you're breaking up these sets, and essentially they're like intervals. You know, so by the end of a heavy squat workout, you do five fives and you do five fives on the bench, and then you know, you pull your deadlift set of five, maybe do some back offs. You have broken down a good chunk of glycogen. I mean, you're not going to be glycogen depleted unless you're in a low carb, on a low carb diet. So that puts it all in the context to answer your question. If you're on a low carb diet, you now don't have enough fuel to sustain all those sets. So what I've typically seen when people aren't eating enough, the first set goes fine, and then things start to go to hell after like set two or three. Yeah, just the same thing. It just happens a little bit differently. And since you're not using as much during a lifting session as you would during an aerobic session, it just kind of builds up over time. And after a couple of workouts, let's say, you know, you just started low carb on Monday, you might get away with Monday's workout because you still have some glucose stores in there. Maybe Tuesday, you're going to break down some more. By workout three, you're just, like you said, you're going to feel like crap because you can't power through it, you know? And then you're in a negative energy balance too. So you're not producing as much ATP either because of overall calories.
You mentioned ATP. I want to go there. So how does our body create more ATP? Is that where creatine comes into play?
Creatine and ATP are two separate things. So ATP is your body's energy source. I mean, everything you eat, like carbs, fat, protein, all of that's converted into ATP. And it happens at different rates, and you get different amounts depending on the macro. So you'll get a lot of ATP from a gram of fat. Obviously, it's 9 calories per gram. But you can't readily access it because it takes longer to, you know, break down, digest, and absorb a fat versus a carb. It's more readily available.
So beginning when you laid out sort of how our body partitions macronutrients as we consume them, you made the point that as you consume more carbs, you burn more carbs, right? Your body becomes more efficient. Is that why, like, when you eat a lot of carbs, like, you start feeling hungrier, like, more? Like, I've noticed that when I eat higher carb, like, man, I'm like, I'm hungry again. And I just ate like an hour ago. Is that what's going on? Is like my body has gotten really good at burning those carbs. So like, it's like, hey, give me some more carbs.
That's part of the reason. So each macronutrient has a thermic effect, which means that the digestion and absorption of fat, carb, and protein is different. So protein has the highest thermic effect of food, which is another benefit to a high protein diet that's not muscle related. If you eat a diet higher in protein, hypothetically, you're going to burn more calories than if you eat a diet lower in protein. How much? Not really a huge amount, but it just takes more energy to break down and absorb and digest protein. Carb would be second. And then fat would be last because fat just gets stored very easily. Your body likes efficiency. Let's just put it that way. You know, let's say that you're on a low fat diet, right? And you're eating a bunch of carbs. You know, you're feeling hungry all the time. Well, let's also not forget that carbs have half the calories of fat. So you have to eat twice the amount of food in terms of volume, food weight, to get that number of calories. So to give you an example, there's a 2001 study by a scientist named David Jenkins, and they were looking at the effects of very high fiber diets on cholesterol levels. So it wasn't a weight loss study or anything. But what was cool about this study was, I mean, they fed the people, they had them stay there overnight. And actually, I'm not sure if they stayed overnight or if they just prepared the food and they picked it up, but they provided these people with the food. The interesting thing about it was they reported the grams the weight in grams of each item that they gave the person on the menu. And they had two groups. One group ate 100% of their carbs from starch, and one group ate 100% of their carbs from fruits and vegetables. The group that ate 100% of their carbs from fruits and vegetables, they were on a 2,700 calorie diet. I believe 60% of it was carbohydrate, roughly 20% of it was fat, and then about 15 to 20% protein, just ballpark figures. And it was 2,700 calorie diet. So now let's think about this. 65% of that 2,700 calories is going to come from carbohydrates. And those carbohydrates have to be 100% from fruits and vegetables, because that was the treatment condition. So if you do the math on that, that's 405 carbs, only fruits and vegetables. So try to picture what that looks like.
Yeah, it's not, it looks like a big giant salad bowl.
Yeah, so they actually, when you total up the weight of all the food items on that menu, it was 11 pounds of food. And needless to say, their bowel movements did change.
If we eat more carbs, become more efficient at burning them. Like, at what point is like too many carbs too much, and then your body starts storing that as fat?
So the term for that is de novo lipogenesis. And that basically means when you're converting a macronutrient that's not fat into stored body fat. And it's a metabolically inefficient process, which means that your body doesn't like to do it. And you have to overfeed carbs while keeping fat low to theoretically pull this off. So let's say that you're on a 20 gram of fat diet, right? And you're trying to get fat from eating carbs, because this would be the best way to do it, right? If you're not getting enough fat in, you can't store it. So let's try to think about what that looks like. 20 grams of fat and 500 carbs. So that's 2,000 calories from carbs, right? And you're probably getting protein in there too. I mean, I don't think it's going to be tough to accomplish, but to better answer that question, they've published papers on this, and it's the estimated number, I believe, is 125 to 175% of the calories you need, your total daily calories, to achieve that. So, and then you also have to, you got to factor in fat too, because you're going to store the fat first. So let's say that you burn 2,000 calories. That means you have to eat 2,000 calories in carb, right? So that's about 500 calories or 500 carbohydrates that you have to eat. And then you're also going to store the fat first, right? So let's say you drop your fat to 20. So you store those first 20 grams, and then you have to eat basically pounds upon pounds of food to accomplish what you're talking about. And I think in the study where they were able to induce it, I think it took that many carbs. So let's say like 500 to 600 carbs, and I don't remember what the fat intake was. And it was like a fraction of a pound of fat came from the carbohydrates based on what they were using to measure it.
Okay. So one thing I want to point out with what you just said about fat gain, when you consume, you only gain fat whenever, you only gain fat when you eat a caloric surplus, and it's that fat that you've eaten will be converted into stored body fat first. Is that how it works?
Yeah. So pretty much, first and foremost, you have to be eating over maintenance for this to happen. You have to be in a caloric surplus to induce fat gain. So assuming that you're eating more energy than you're expending, the first thing that's going to happen is whatever fat calories you're taking in, that's going to go to your stored fat first before you do any type of de novo lipogenesis. And again, you have to eat a lot of carbs or a lot of protein theoretically to induce that. But let's just assume you're a typical American on a high fat, high carb diet. You're eating, 300-400 carbs a day and 200 grams of fat. You're going to store the fat first, and then that's going to accumulate over time.
All right. So like the takeaway there then is like people get fat, not because of carbs probably. It's probably they're eating like fatty carbs. They're eating, like you said, hamburgers, pizza, what ding dongs, whatever. Like it's like carbs that are like, I think you've said this phrase, they're fortified with fat.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. I say that our American diet is very much fortified with fat. The easiest way to essentially get fat, if your goal was to, gain body fat, would be on a high carb, high fat diet. Because what do we know now? You're going to burn off the carbs. You're going to store the fat. So if you're eating a high carb, high fat diet, you're on the fast track to, gaining a bunch of body fat. That's why Oreos are so lovely for that,
What about protein? Does protein ever get converted to fat, or is that same thing with carbs? Like it's inefficient, so your body doesn't like to do it.
Your body likes efficiency, but protein, good luck trying to eat that much. I mean, you'll be full before you're even a quarter of the way there.
Right. And another thing, I think it's so fascinating about the body is, like, again, it likes efficiency, and, you know, it requires it requires glucose or glycogen to, you know, to think and do these other functions. One of the things I've read in, like, sort of the high fat, low carb blogosphere books is that one problem some folks run into is they're eating a high fat, high protein diet, low carb, that, like, I guess the body can, like, convert protein into glycogen in some weird way. And so you end up, like, getting out of ketosis because you ate too much protein.
Sure. So what you're talking about there is another fancy scientific term called gluconeogenesis. And that's basically where you're converting non-carbohydrate macronutrients into glucose. It can happen with fat too, although it's very hard to do. But it's when you're eating, let's say you're on a low carb diet that's high in fat, high in protein, and you're eating a ton of protein and you're not utilizing it, protein can be converted into glucose a lot easier than fat via this process. Your body likes efficiency. You know what I mean? So yes, that could happen. You can definitely start converting protein into glucose if your body needs it. That's why I noticed some of these keto people, they'll restrict protein too and just try to get as much of it from fat as possible.
Right. And then that's not good for gains. You need protein to build muscle, man.
Absolutely.
Right. So, okay. I mean, we've talked a lot, and this goes to show, like, why there's so much confusion about nutrition. Cause, like, it's a relatively complex process going on. We're not just a process, processes going on all at the same time. So let's recap some of this theoretical stuff, and then we can get into sort of the practical stuff. So I guess big takeaways that I got: we need protein, carbs, and fat for functioning. Carbs are good. We need carbs for high intensity exercise, thinking, like, our brain requires it. The more carbs we eat, we get more efficient at carbs. Fat, like, when we consume fat, like, if we consume a lot of fat, we get better at burning that dietary fat, that fat we consume, not stored fat.
As long as carbs are low.
And the other takeaway is, I mean, if you want to lose weight, you have to be in a caloric deficit. That means you have to eat fewer calories than you are burning.
Absolutely. Yep. That's correct.
Okay. This is good. This is useful. So let's talk about, okay, how do we, knowing this and taking this and applying it to different, you know, health goals that people might have. So, sort of broadly speaking, when you program nutrition for a client, what's your approach? Is it like counting calories, macros? Is it some sort of, like, you know, zone body diet? Like, what's your big picture approach?
Generally, this is going to depend on the person. So I like macros. I like meal plan, and it depends on who I'm working with. So if you have a guy, and this comes back to just being practical and individualizing your care. So if you have an individual who is on a pretty regimented schedule every single day, it doesn't have much variation there, a meal plan tends to work good, you know? And if you have somebody who is traveling all the time or works all day one day and then, you know, has time spread out the next day, I like macros better, like total macros. But above all, basically the overarching theme is I like to figure out their macros first. And the way I do that is I have everybody track whether I'm going to put them on a meal plan or not. After that week is over, I'll look at what they're normally eating because I want to get some idea of their usual intake. Obviously, what people write down isn't necessarily what's going on, but it's something, you know. And this, we're not doing a research paper here. We're working with humans. So in this case, it is better than nothing because I need something to work with them on. And based on what they give me, then I'll reconfigure things. Typically, with an average person, you're going to see high fat, high carb, low protein. And then you got to reconfigure those macros. Now, if I'm putting them on a meal plan, I'm going to give them a schedule. Be like, okay, eat this much carb, fat, and protein for this meal, and then eat every 3 to 5 hours, depending on what their schedule is. If you can't eat this time, move it to this time. And that'll be what I do for that person. For the other person who doesn't want all that structure and likes to, you know, fly by the seat of their pants, I'll say, okay, you need to get this total amount of carb, this total amount of fat, this total amount of protein, this total amount of fiber throughout the whole day. Don't really care how you break it up. Just try not to do it all in one meal, one or two meals. Try to get at least 3 meals, you know? And that's pretty much how I start somebody. I guess the real thing I'm trying to communicate here is there's no 100% accurate way to figure out where somebody is at baseline. You know, you just have to get some rough estimate based on either what they're giving you or some validated equation and then work from there. So that's where having a coach is really helpful, because it's really how it becomes individualized. You know, I can give you something that, you know, a cookie cutter template that I just hand over to you and you run off with. And, you know, if you're experienced with dieting, you're going to probably do great with it, you know, because you've been through it enough times to know your body. But if you're taking a raw novice dieter, for lack of a good word, and you give them something that's cookie cutter, they're probably going to mess it up and not do what's written on there and have a bunch of problems. And that's where the coaching becomes very helpful, because you get to know how the person's body responds and kind of build around that.
So it sounds like one of the approach you mentioned, like with the macro, it's like that's if it fits your macros. And I think that's what you've been having me do. You just said, here's these macros. You haven't really given me a meal plan, and just like hit these macros, track them with, I use MyFitnessPal, and then I report to you sort of like how I did that week.
Yeah, sure. I do that for a lot of people, and that's typically my default because it's more laid back for some people. But what I'm finding is, you know, a lot of people, there's other people out there that like structure too. I'd say it's probably half and half, but I usually start with macros because it's all based on macros. So I always start with total macros because it's simple. It's easier to wrap your mind around, you know, and then as the person goes on, if they're cool with that, you stick with it. If they're not, you say, okay, here's a little more structure. But ultimately, both approaches depend on macros and total calories, you know?
So let's talk about fitness goals or, you know, nutrition goals. So I think the same, I've heard this kind of thrown around, like 80% of weight loss is diet and 20% is exercise. So diet's a big key. So like losing body fat is a big goal for a lot of people. Let's start with someone who's like, you know, who's really overweight, right? We're talking above 20%, what do we consider like obese in terms of body fat?
I'd say once you start getting over 30% body fat, you're probably in pretty bad shape. Let's say
you're over 30% body fat. Like what's your sort of broad, again, it's going to be personalized individual for each person, but like broadly speaking, like what's your recommendation on calories and macronutrients?
So if you have a 250 pound guy who's always been 250 pounds and tends to be, you know, what we would call a non-responder to, you know, weight loss. Typically, most of those guys, if let's say he's lifting weights, he's strong, you know, he's done the program for a couple of years, you know, got his squat up, got his deadlift up, wants to lose weight. Typically, I'd start somebody like that. Let's get the fat at 100 for the high end to start, because most people come in here eating like, you know, over 100 grams of fat a day. So putting them on like 60 or 70 in the beginning is going to freak them out, you know? So when I get these guys that are used to eating a lot of fat, I'll say, okay, let's go to 100 on fat. And then I'll typically put their carbs somewhere around 250 and protein around 200, 225. And for various reasons, not because they need that much protein to build muscle. That's not why I'm doing that. So, you know, just to be clear, you don't need that much protein to build muscle mass, but protein has other functions. So it helps keep you full and during a diet that's important. So I tend to go higher on the protein for that. Two, it also helps with glycemic response. So it helps you get stable blood glucose and insulin levels.
Okay. Like how much weight should they be shooting for a week losing? Is it like 1 to 2 pounds?
Yeah, typically 1 to 2 pounds. I mean, if they lose more and they're still able to train, I don't say, oh my God, let's eat more food. But if they lose more and they're getting gassed in their first week, then I say, okay, hold on, we need to eat a little bit more.
Right. Okay. So it's going to be, so yeah, you're going to also, because this is assuming that the person you're working with is also training with weights. And so you're also, not only are you taking into account, okay, we want to lose weight, lose body fat, but we also want to make sure your performance stays, you know, good as well.
Yeah. And that's where the term, I love this term, well-balanced diet. That's where that becomes more important when you're dealing with an athlete or somebody who is doing some sort of intense activity that they care about, that they want to preserve their function in. So the extreme diets don't tend to work on that front. So you have to keep the carbs high, reasonably high, so that you can still train, and you have to keep the protein at a certain level. And then that's where, you know, the only one you have left is fat. And that's why we tend to gravitate towards low fat diets for lifters, because it's not really contributing much to performance, if anything. So that's where we start to cut first. And I don't know if you've done both, I'm assuming low carb and low fat, right?
Right.
With low carb, you're going to feel symptoms of weakness a lot faster than low fat.
Right. No. Yeah. I experienced that. I think before I started working with you, I did, you know, when I first started training, I did high fat, low carb. So I thought I was going to lose some weight. And like, I just, What ended up happening was I got really weak and I got fatter and I didn't feel good. And I told Matt, I was like, I need to not do this. I went to like a higher carb, lower fat and started feeling great. Lifts started going up and I started losing weight, which was, I thought, really counterintuitive based on all the information I had been consuming for the past 5 years about how nutrition works and whatever. And I imagine as someone's losing weight, like I'm talking about our 250-pound guy, that as he loses weight, you also need to keep reducing calories to keep the weight drive, weight loss going.
Sure. Yeah, of course. So I think you experienced that, you know, this past week. Eventually you get to a point where you can't lose more. Yeah, depending on how much weight you have to lose and who you are, you know, you might start getting weaker, feeling like crap, etc. But the only way to continue driving additional weight loss is to cut back. And I take a different the approach I like to take is, let's say you got a guy who's 300 pounds and he loses the first 30 or 40 pounds, no problem. And then he's like, oh, crap, I'm missing my bench press, feeling hungry all the time. I'm having dreams about food, and you're getting all these psychological symptoms that kind of, you know, start arising. That's when I say, whoa, hold on, buddy. Let's put the brakes on. You know, we're going to up your calories, get you into a maintenance phase, and just have you train for a while and not worry about fat loss. And from there, we'll do that. And then, you know, after, depends on the person. I like 3 months. I find that some clients, they want to just go right back to it. So we'll do a month. But in a perfect world, I like 3 to 6 months because it gives you enough time away from dieting, allows you to eat, you know, live a reasonably normal life for a while before you go right back to it. And so let's say, you know, our 300-pound guy is 260 now. And then 6 months later, he's been training, got his strength back up a little bit. Now we're going to take him from 260 down to 220. And then at 230, he starts saying, oh, I'm hungry again, and this is happening. So I stop at 230 instead. I say, okay, we're not going to go to 220. We'll go to 230. And we'll stop again. And then maybe a few months down the line, try it a third time. And this approach seems to work in terms of, you know, keeping the performance together during a period of fat loss.
No, that's really interesting. Because I think when most people think fat loss, they think they're just going to do it in one fell swoop. Like I'm going to transfer, like, you know, the headlines you see on the magazines that when you check out at the grocery store, lose 30 pounds of body fat in 2 months. Like, it sounds like that you don't do that, because that could probably just destroy you psychologically. And also, you know, it can hurt your training as well.
Yeah. If you start losing it rapidly, first of all, it's going to mess with your head. You're going to have psychological problems that arise from that. Two, it's going to mess up your training. And three, you're more likely to gain the weight back because you went on a severe, crazy restriction that you couldn't sustain, you know?
I imagine as you get lower in body fat, right? Let's say you're a guy, you're like in the 18% body fat range, right? So you're looking pretty jacked, but you're not shredded yet, right? And say like that's your goal. You want six-pack abs. Does it get really hard to like lose, or I guess we're not losing, we're shrinking those fat cells. Does it become harder as you get lower in body fat?
Yeah. Yeah. The leaner you get, the harder your body fights back. And it's a survival mechanism there. And I'm always telling people this. I'm like, after a certain point, your body's going to fight back. And why does that happen? Because historically, you know, we have mechanisms in place to protect us for during times of famine. And one of those mechanisms is you store a bunch of body fat so that if there's no food available, you have some energy to use, right? Once you get to a certain point of fat loss and you're trying to get, you know, jacked and tan, your body's like, well, hold on a second. That's my savings account. And you're trying to empty it out completely. I don't want to do that. And then you start getting, you know, an upregulation of hunger hormones. So now you're hungry all the time. You're getting cravings. Your brain stops functioning correctly. Lose your sex drive. It's basically your body's way of saying, I'm not getting rid of this. You're not cleaning my bank account out.
I mean, and we can talk about my experience working with you. So I started working with you about, 2 months ago?
Yeah.
About, 2 months ago. So before that time, I'd been kind of, Matt, my barbell coach, starting strength coach, kind of gave me general recommendations. I started working with you after I did the last meet in March in Wichita Falls. And before that time, I was eating like 350 grams of carbs, 220 grams of protein, and 70 grams of fat, 80 or 90 grams of fat. So it was about 3,500 to 3,600 calories. And I was doing that right before the meet because I was just like focusing on getting big and strong, right? I wanted to perform well. I weighed out at the meet at 219. So I just got under that cutoff on the weight. And I told Matt, it's like, you know what? I got fat. I think my waist was up. I can't remember my initial measurement. I think it was like 37 inches when I reported to you the first time.
Yeah, that sounds right.
36. Yeah. And I said, yeah, I want to take a break from this and maybe, you know, trim down a bit. And so you gave me the recommendation. We went down to 2,500 calories about. So we were at 250 carbs, 250 protein. You increased the protein to help with that satiation. And we went 60 grams fat. Things were like, I mean, I was telling you, man, this is awesome. Like I was doing great, feeling great for the first, I would say 6 weeks. Performance really didn't suffer too much in during training. But like this week, I think like I hit a wall.
Yeah.
I remember I sent you an email. I was like, dude, I'm hungry all the time. And it like got to the point, it was distracting. Like during my work, I couldn't get work done because I was just like, I'm hungry. I got to eat something. And I would go to bed hungry and I hated it. And I was like, but I mean, I made progress. Like I went from 37 inch waist. I think yesterday measured at 33¾ inch waist. And I went from 219, weighing out at 219. Well, I mean, here's the thing. When you weigh out, for people who don't know, when you do a strength or a weightlifting competition, like all day, you're just consuming carbs and water, you know, because you're again, you want that, because it's a really taxing day. You're lifting all day, doing these really heavy single lifts. So you need that glucose to keep you powered so you don't bottom out. So yeah, you store a lot of water and glycogen. The next day I weighed 225 pounds. And then just going back to my normal diet, I went back to 219 because I shed all that water, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, so I went from 219 to 208, which is pretty, like in 2 months, I 8 pounds and lost about 4 inches on my waist. But like, and I was like, man, maybe I can go for like 6-pack. And then like this week I was like, no, it's not worth it. And I asked you, like, is this going to get harder? And if so, like, I don't know if it's worth it.
Right. Yeah. So that's the thing, you know, like I was talking to somebody this morning, a client of mine that was visiting in town. I went to breakfast with her. We were talking about that. And I'm like, at a certain point, fat loss becomes like a sport and there are risks associated with it. You know, you have the risk of injury when you're under the bar, you know, musculoskeletal injury. When you're dieting really hard, you have the risk of anxiety, depression, low energy, decreased libido. Like these are all risks of continuing down that path. And it's, I like to relate it to sport, you know, because it comes to a certain point where, okay, your dieting is no longer about health. Now you have some sort of a competitive goal there, whether you're actually competing in bodybuilding or not is irrelevant. Like there are people that chase, you know, a 600 pound deadlift that never go on the platform. You know, that's still a competitive endeavor, you know? So I tell people, I'm like, if you're trying to get jacked and tan, that is a bucket list / competitive endeavor. And it's no longer about health at that point. So what you have to understand is, yes, you are going to feel hungry. You're going to be dreaming about food. Your sex drive might go down. You know, you might lose energy. You might not be able to train. You might lose weight off the bar. Like all these negative things could start happening. And for some people, there's long-term consequences to that if they do that too much. And then for others, it's fine, you know, again, genetics. But yeah, so then the question becomes, is it really worth it? Why are you, you know, if you really want to see your abs, and that's an important goal to you, then yeah, push through it. But these things are going to happen. So like I went through that like a few years ago, it's been 2 years now. Wow. I wanted to get down pretty low because I'd been so heavy for a while and it wasn't serving me. I wasn't lifting more. I was, the amount of weight gain that I had put on didn't, you know, the weight on the bar didn't justify it. So I wanted to take myself down and I wanted to take myself way down. So I got myself down to like 11.8% body fat. This is not bodybuilder levels. That's like bodybuilders are 5% ish, you know, if you're not DEXA. And even at that point, I was like hungry all the time, dizzy. I'd go to the gym, I'd do my squats and I'd see spots afterwards. And, you know, that's, again, that was at that point, it wasn't about health. You know, it stopped being about health once I got under 15% body fat, you know, I would even argue 20, you know. At that point, it was about, I want to get really lean because I've always wanted to do it and I want to see if it's possible. And, you know, for me, it fortunately was. For some people, that may not be something that's possible without possibly surgery, you know. But yeah, at that point, I knew it wasn't about health. And even the lifting I was doing was not about health. You know, I'm not a very impressive lifter, but the amount that I lift is not necessary for me to be functional and healthy. You know, I do that competitively in terms of I compute myself on it. I want these PRs. I want these numbers. So the same thing goes for leanness. You know, at a certain point, your leanness no longer becomes about health, and you know, you are putting your safety on the line to some extent.
Right. So you have to decide if it's worth it. I decide it's not worth it. Right. I was like, I'd rather, I want to get that 600 pound deadlift and I'm okay. Like I'm healthy. I look good right now and I'm happy. And I just don't, I'm just not shredded, but I'm okay with that.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. No, so we've been talking losing weight. So I guess the thing is there, I like the big takeaway from there is that if your goal is to lose weight and maintain performance, whether it's you're an endurance athlete or a strength athlete, to do it in stages. Like don't try to do it all in one fell swoop. Do it for 2 months, take a break for 3 months, then go at it again. Let's talk about gaining weight. There's some guys who are listening to this. They're like the stereotypical, you know, Charles Atlas ad, like this, you know, 90-pound weakling or whatever. Like they get sand kicked. Like they want to put on some mass and be bigger. But I've got friends who are like no matter how much they eat, like I don't gain weight. So what's going on with those guys and what do they need to do to gain weight?
I guess I'll talk about what I did and how I apply this to other people. So like I said, a couple years ago, you know, I got myself down to like 11% body fat. I worked with Nick Shaw of Renaissance Periodization. He helped me with that. And then afterwards, I just kept training, went on my own, been kind of just doing my own thing with diet. And I kind of took that knowledge to kind of explain what I just did. Then later on, I was like, okay, I need to get stronger. My programming is all over the place. And then I hired Reynolds. And he started doing my strength coaching, and I just did my own thing with diet. And that's also when I sat in an obesity class here at ASU, which I recommend to anybody in the state of Arizona that, you know, has access to ASU and can take a graduate level elective. There's this obesity and health class taught by Glenn Gaser. He's an obesity expert. And that's where I learned a lot of this stuff about nutrient oxidation. So as I'm sitting in that class, taking all this information in, I was like, okay, wait a minute. I'm like, I need to gain muscle mass and I want to skew that weight gain towards muscular body weight and away from fat weight. So if any more carbs cause you to burn more carbs and store less fat, then what if I just pull the fat back, ramp the carbs up, and just keep training? What would happen? So I tried that. I tried a very low fat diet initially. Reynolds thought I was insane because I got all the way down to 15 just to experiment. Didn't last very long, but I think the lowest I saw on my tracker was 15. And then I ramped my carbs up to 400. And seriously, it was like I took speed. The next time I lifted, my squat just got dramatically easier. It was like, it was awesome, you know? So I kept doing that. And over time, this has been what? I've been with Matt for 16 months. Over time, I've gained about 12, 13 pounds. And my deadlift went from 440 to 500. My squat went from 370 to 420. I don't care what Rip says. It was still, that's what I base my percentages off of. Yeah, 370 to 420. And my my bench went from, I think, 269 to 291. And my press is back at 205. Although I had 211, I start to faint when I'm pressing. I can't figure out how to control that, but I faint halfway up and I can't seem to lock anything out over 205 without passing out. So right now it's 205. Now to you know, be clear on that, I pressed 210 at 205 before. I benched 290 at 205 before. But these squat and deadlifts, these are big PRs. Like I never hit that when I was fat. These happened when I was lean. And anyways, so my whole thing about it was, I'm like, okay, it takes muscle takes a long time to gain. You don't gain it in a week or 2 weeks or even a month. I mean, yeah, in a month probably you start building some muscle. And I've been trained because I've been lifting weights for almost 19 years, I think. I started in 1999. And I've been squatting and deadlifting. I've been squatting for about 16 years, and I've been deadlifting for about 5. I mean, I've always done the lifts that I've trained consistently are the squat and the bench and the pull-up. I mean, you know, I've been doing that consistently since I started lifting weights. I added the deadlift and the press about 8 years ago now. Wow. And so I bring all that up because I'm a trained lifter. I'm not a novice, you know. So the more trained you become, the less muscle you're going to gain over time. Eventually, you stop gaining muscle mass, right? The way I looked at it was, I'm just going to train, focus on pushing my weight up on the bar. You know, I'm not going to worry about my body weight. I'm going to let my body weight do what it does. I'm going to eat enough so that I'm getting through these workouts and setting new PRs. And the reason I say that is because what drives muscle gain? So like I always get these questions from guys saying, I want a mass. Can you give me a diet to mass? And I'm like, yeah, but what's your training looking like? You know, I don't like giving people mass diets that I'm not coaching, because if you're not stimulating the muscle correctly, you're not going to gain muscle. No, you know, it's like saying, okay, I'm going to give you a diet. You're going to follow it and gain muscle mass without lifting weights. I mean, the diet supplements the training. The training is the stimulus. So when I'm talking to guys about gaining weight, the first thing I say is either work with me or work with a strength coach that's competent, because the stimulus for building muscle is the strength training. You have to get stronger at it over time. So that gets into a whole nother, you know, ball of wax when you're talking about programming. But my whole approach with it is, if you're performing more over time, let's say you're lifting more weight 6 months from now, you know, for a set of 10, a set of five, a set, it really doesn't matter. I mean, the research says it, us as coaches have seen it. If you train eights and get stronger at eights, you're going to get bigger muscles. If you train fives and get stronger at fives, you're going to get bigger muscles. If you do even 12s, you'll get bigger muscles, as long as you're improving within that rep range. The bottom line is the training stimulates the growth. Then you have to eat to facilitate that. So you got to figure, okay, if you're gaining 15 pounds in a month and you're a trained lifter like myself, I'd say probably 95% of that's going to be fat. So it's going to be slower. The more advanced you become, the slower the weight gain is going to be, and the less body weight you're going to gain as a trained lifter versus a novice. You know, that guy gains 10 pounds in a month. Maybe half of that's muscle. You know, maybe gains 5 pounds of muscle in his first month. Or I should say lean mass is more like it, because a novice, they're going to increase blood volume. They're going to increase glycogen stores. That's going to increase their lean weight. They'll probably start building muscle around week six, and then that'll continue over time. So in like a 3 to 6 month period, a novice might gain 5 to 10 pounds of muscle, depending on how well that person responds to strength training. To just tie it all together, the bottom line is your training must facilitate growth in order for the diet to be meaningfully effective.
And I think a lot of times these guys who say they have a hard time gaining weight, and they say they eat a lot, they probably don't actually eat a lot, because they're not tracking. They just think they do, but they really don't.
With the guys that say they eat a lot, again, you're dealing with self-reported dietary intake, you know, when something is not better than nothing. In this case, what I found, my cousin was one of these guys. I eat so much and I can't gain weight. He was like 6 foot, 150 pounds. And I got him up to 217. So that's an interesting thing happened there. You know, like we said, eventually you can't lose weight. There is a point where your body will stop gaining weight. And for him, it was 217. No matter how much he ate, he couldn't gain any more weight. And this guy was committed, man. But in the beginning, when I gave him recommendations on food, he gained like 20 pounds, I think, you know, 25 pounds. He was like 180, maybe 185. And then he just started bitching that, oh, it's too much food. I can't eat like this. And then we stopped talking for a couple months. He came back around and he's like, all right, I want to try and do this right, you know? So I was like, okay. So it took this guy 555 or 575 carbs, 175 grams of fat, and I think 250 grams of protein for him to get his weight up to 218. And I mean, the guy did great.
How many calories is that? It's like 4,000.
I think he was like between 4 and 5. It was like creeping towards 5,000 calories a day. And what that?
Wow.
Yeah. And what that looked like was like, for instance, he's like, yeah, when I lift, he's like, I put a cup of sugar in my protein shake, you know, because he needs all these carbs. And he puts a cup of sugar in his protein shake. And then he was eating like a loaf of bread, a pound of beef, a quart of milk, and a bunch of, those breakfast potatoes. And that was a meal for him. And he was just miserable eating all that food. But, you know, he got all the lifts he wanted. He pulled 405 for five, squatted 315 for five, benched 220, pressed 150. And, you know, he lost some of that when he ended up losing the weight, but he kept most of it. He's one of those guys now. He looks like he plays basketball or looks like a swimmer. But then when he starts loading the bar up, people stare at him because he doesn't look like somebody that can, you know, squat close to 400 pounds, you know?
So yeah, there's some nice takeaways there. Some other brass tack things that I've learned from you that I think people might find useful. So we talked about carbs. You don't just want to eat like fast burning carbs, like, you know, like bread and grain. Like you want to eat carbs that have fiber. And you have me set at 40 grams of fiber a day, which when I first saw that, I was like, that's hard because like most food doesn't have a lot of fiber in it, right? You look at the breakdown in the bag, it's like 3 grams of fiber, 2 grams of fiber. But you pointed me in the direction of these like Mission tortillas, the carb balance tortillas. And I think the one I'm having right now, like it has like 14 or 13 grams of carb or fiber in it. So it's like right there, I almost got like a quarter of my fiber done just with my breakfast burrito in the morning. So thank you for letting me know about that. So other good high fiber sources of raspberries have become my jam. Like I eat raspberry, like a couple of raspberries a day. It's fantastic. Pinto beans, another one. Like just with those three things, I get my 40 grams of fiber in and I'm good. And then, you know, for mostly I eat, you know, breakfast, it's like eggs, egg whites and an egg. So I get my fat and my protein. I got the Mission tortilla going on in there. Then I usually train. And then after that, after I train, I'll have whey protein shake. And then let me get your take on this. This is kind of how I get my carbs and my whey protein. I buy oat flour and rice flour. And I just put a scoop in there with my whey protein. Cause I'm lazy. I just want to drink my food for my after meal. So I just do like a quarter cup of brown rice flour, which is about 30 grams of carbs after I train. And then lunch, it's usually like some like chicken and sweet potatoes. And then I have like another like snack between lunch and dinner. And that's like whey protein and oat flour shake. And then dinner is like whatever the missus makes. And then I just adjust based on whatever the macro recommendations you've given me. But the other thing I like about, you know, if it fits your macros is the flexibility. Cause like, you know, if I know I'm going to go out to like, so like last week I went out to Texas Roadhouse for dinner with some friends. I was like, man, that's going to be a big giant calorie bomb. I kind of just didn't really eat during the day and just saved everything for that big meal. And I was fine. I didn't like gain a ton of weight. I mean, I did gain a lot of weight because like there's a lot of sodium. So you have a lot of, I guess you retain a lot of water, but like it didn't do a lot of damage to my diet.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much how it goes, you know, it's just water weight. And if your calories are where they need to be, then you're not going to, you know, gain a bunch of fat from that.
Well, did you have something else you want to say? Were you going to hit on something else about if it fits your macros or any other brass tacks advice?
Yeah. So if it fits your macros, what I like about that is, and the way I do it, as you just said, 40 grams of fiber. If you're eating 40 grams of fiber, it is not the if it fits your macros you see on Instagram where people are eating a bunch of pizza and crap and saying, oh, it fits my macros. It's not what we're doing here. So I just want to.
I hate that.
Yeah.
That I think that like does such a big disservice to people because you see all these like super fit people like eating donuts, like donuts, like they're like jacked and like regular people see like, oh, I can eat donuts and look like that too. It's like, well, probably not.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the problem with it. You know, it's kind of misleading. And then you also don't know what these people are really doing. You know, they're putting one picture up saying that they're doing this. And it's like, are they really doing this? You know, so it kind of creates a false image of what that is. The purpose to, if it fits your macros, is to allow flexibility and not demonize food so that, you know, okay, you're eating a healthy diet most of the time, but you want to go eat crap. It's okay. You know, it's not going to kill your gains. Just, you know, play it smart, balance it out, kind of like you would, you know, your money. Use the analogy that, you know, your food is like a checking account. You know, you have so much you can spend, and once you go over, you know, you're going to be in a bad place. So that's kind of how I look at it with that. The other pet peeve that I've been having lately that I meant to bring up earlier is just this idea that the way that weight loss has been prescribed to people is similar to that you would prescribe to a bodybuilder. You know, the expectation is that, hey, you're supposed to lose for 3 months every single week, and that's a successful diet. And it's like, well, no, that's what a competitor does. The average person who has kids, a job, you know, all these other responsibility, travels, has a lot of friends that come over, has a social life, that person may not lose every week. It may take 6, 9 months, maybe a year because of interruptions in the routine, you know? One of the things I find myself talking about a lot lately and is really important is I tell people, yeah, it's kind of like the, you know, starting strength linear progression. You know, in an ideal situation, you have an 18-year-old kid who plays video games all day, lives with mom, and has unlimited access to food. Yeah, he might LP for 3 months straight, add weight to the bar every time, not get hurt, and have a successful linear progression. But for most of us, and Rip writes it in the book, you know, you'll have a few good months, then, you know, life will get in the way, stress, injuries, death in the family, and you'll have to reset, start over. And by the end of it, it's been 9, 10 months, you know, because of all these things. Well, the same applies to diet. you know, you're going to have people that come over and want to eat out, and you're not going to lose weight that week, you know, because you have low calorie needs and the food that you're eating out has almost your entire day's worth in a plate, but you want to eat that and that's okay. You're just not going to lose that week. Next week will be better. You know, maybe that'll happen for 3 weeks in a row before you get into a rhythm for another 3 weeks. So as long as the overall trend is down, just like, you know, when you're lifting, the overall trend is up for the weight on the bar, you're in good shape. But I think that we shouldn't be telling people that their a successful weight loss looks like that of a competitor.
Yeah, I think that, and I guess that's an important part of your job as a dietitian, not only like a scientist, right, where you're prescribing, you know, macronutrients based on, you know, science, right? The theory that we talked about at the beginning, but like, you're also a psychologist in a lot of ways, right? Because you have to help them manage expectations and then help them realize it's okay if you didn't lose your pound this week, we'll get it again next week.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. I think that's good advice for everybody. I know, when I started working with you, that was the first thing you told me. It's like, hey, but you know, I know you want to like look jacked, but I just want to let you know that it's not going to be linear. It's going to go fluctuate up and down. And you have to be okay with that. And like, that was actually really helpful because it prevented me from getting frustrated early on and just being like, okay, it's okay. As long as the trend is down, I'm good.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Robert, this has been a great conversation. Where can people go to learn more about your work? I imagine you've got some stuff up on startingstrength.com.
I am all over the place. So I am at startingstrength.com. I moderate the nutrition forum, so you can find information about me there. I run nutrition at Starting Strength Online Coaching, so you can find me there. I have my own website, weightsandplates.com. You can find me there. Everywhere and anywhere. Hopefully get some scientific journals out soon.
Right. Well, hey, Robert, this has been a great conversation. Thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Yep. Thank you, sir.
My guest today was Robert Santana. He's the nutrition coach at Starting Strength Online Coaching. You also find more information about his work at startingstrength.com. Also check out our show notes at aom.is/Santana, where you can find links to resources, where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy the podcast, I've gotten something out of it, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think would get something out of it. As always, thank you for your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.